This is The Guardian.
I'm Matilda Bosley, coming to you from Wurundjeri land, and this is The Full Story. On the surface, the centre pay system seems pretty innocuous, just a government program designed to help people on welfare simplify their bills and expenses. So how did a woman we call Denise end up paying $6,500 for a television worth just a fraction of the price? In fact, this program is the common thread in a huge range of alleged misdealings, from an energy giant taking money from the vulnerable to rehabilitation patients being subjected to exorcism and gay conversion therapy. Today, Indigenous Affairs editor Lorena Ellum and Chief Investigations Correspondent Christopher Norse untangle the centre pay web. It's Thursday, the 11th of April.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
So, Lorena and Chris, you've both spent a lot of time looking into the issue with centre pay. I have to admit, though, before I started reading your work, I had never heard of it before. Chris, would you be able to tell me what is centre pay?
Yeah, so centre pay is a system that was set up in the late 1990s under the Howard government with, on the face of it, quite good intentions. So it's effectively a budgeting tool. So it's run by Services Australia, which is the federal government department that manages Centrelink payments. And it allows people to budget their welfare payment in a way that ensures it covers essentials like electricity or rent by automatically deducting those things from their welfare payment before it hits their bank account. The problem is that over the decades that it's been in existence, the centre pay system has been increasingly opened up to unscrupulous operators and people who have used it to exploit the most vulnerable and disadvantaged people in Australia.
I was sort of aware of centre pay as a vehicle for what financial counsellors are calling financial abuse through reporting on the collapsed funeral fund, ACBF UPLA. It went belly up in 2022, owing millions, Aboriginal people mostly, vulnerable Aboriginal people had paid a fortune into this fund and have lost everything. UPLA was allowed to get onto centre pay, and when it was on centre pay, managed to rake in about $169 million from people who were signed up to these junk funeral policies. So I knew about centre pay from that, but what I didn't realise was how widespread the issue was. It wasn't just UPLA. We found numerous examples of companies that are using centre pay to really target vulnerable people.
And that has been allowed by this just huge lack of scrutiny by anyone, by government in particular, as to who is accessing centre pay and how it is being used to get hold of welfare recipients' money. So we've come across cases, quite shocking cases, where individual welfare recipients have been left with absolutely nothing after businesses have come in and used centre pay to take away various parts of their welfare payments. So it quickly became clear to us as we worked through this investigation that there is a serious problem here in terms of exploitation and in terms of a lack of scrutiny.
So, Lorena, tell me a little bit about what you've uncovered.
Yes, so most recently, Urban Rampage is a clothing company They have 10 stores that are mostly based around regional and remote areas. Their main client base is Aboriginal people in remote communities whose access to these goods and services is otherwise quite limited. Now, that people will use CenterPay and go in and buy clothing and blankets and other household essentials for their family, and they don't have to pay up front. So it's an attractive proposition to people who have a limited income but need certain things. You know, the weather changes and they need a blanket. Urban Rampage can offer them to pay it off over time in installments on their welfare payments. And that on the surface seems like a good thing. But financial counsellors are alleging that Urban Rampage charges very high prices for these items, things that people could buy much more cheaply at a chain store like Kmart or Target. But they, of course, they don't go to those stores because they can't afford to pay $20 up front, but they can afford to rack up a big debt with a company like Urban Rampage and only pay it back in installments. In February, the company was issued an interim stop order by ASIC, the financial regulator, because ASIC had concerns that CenterPay deductions were leaving people with no money at the end of their pay cycle. They, you know, people were seeking food because they couldn't afford to eat.
And what has the company Urban Rampage said about this stop order and the allegations of financial abuse?
The company is really angry about this, and they've said that they're strongly disputing what ASIC has to say. Urban Rampage says it's been audited 19 times by Services Australia since 2016 and never failed an audit. And they say CenterPay is a good system that is, quote, their quote, backstopped by the Commonwealth government. And CenterPay isn't a vehicle for financial abuse, and that they are often helping people who are experiencing hardship. They say there's a maximum amount that can be deducted in any payment cycle of $200. So what they're saying is that when if a welfare recipient has more than $200 in a pay cycle, they're entitled to take $200 of it. But what it doesn't consider is all the other CenterPay commitments that that person has. So while one company might be able to take $200 out of that person's account, other companies that that person has signed up to can do so also. So it's not unusual for people to be left with nothing when their pay comes in.
I mean, just how widespread is this alleged exploitation of CenterPay?
Well, when Chris and I started looking at the CenterPay register, we, you know, there's more than 15,000 businesses now registered to use CenterPay. And we looked through the register and we managed to identify a number of businesses that ASIC itself has already said it has concerns about. And they're mostly rent-to-buy schemes, which are very problematic for people on low incomes because they often involve huge, you know, markups and over time paying back much more than the goods are worth over time to these rent-to-buy schemes. And they seem to be, you know, proliferating on CenterPay.
And Lorena, you actually spoke to a woman who, for privacy reasons, we're calling Denise, and she used one of these rent-to-buy schemes to purchase a TV. Can you tell me a bit about her story?
Yes, so I spoke to Denise, who's a single mother of five kids, and she was staying with family in Queensland when this rent-to-buy company knocked on the front door and suggested that she could rent to buy a television for her kids. And she knew about this company because other family members and other people had already got contracts with them. So she signed up and she told me that she didn't have a chance to read or understand what she had signed. Turns out she had signed a Word document generated by the company, not by Services Australia or the government, and had inadvertently ticked a box that said that gave them permission to take these payments indefinitely. So she signed up to buy the TV, was started paying $86 a fortnight out of her welfare payments to the company. For some reason, the payments halted. There was some mix-up at Services Australia. As soon as the payments halted, the company started, she said, threatening her and insisting that she repay the debt, at which point she asked for a contract, copy of the contract. She hadn't had one before. She didn't know how much she had paid. She had no record of what she still owed. And at that point, she was so scared that she contacted a financial counsellor who managed to identify that she had paid $6,500 for a TV that had a retail value of $1,400. And at that point, she cancelled the payments. So Denise's view is you know, these are things that you can't get locally. If you live in a remote community, if you live in the Torres Strait or you live in, you know, the Kimberley somewhere and it's 4 hours to town, you have very limited options in how you can purchase these goods. You can't shop around. You don't have time to look at six different options and often they're big ticket items, so you can't pay up front. So CenterPay is a good way to access these goods. But people are being exposed to rent-to-buy schemes where they're being charged way more than things are worth because they have limited financial literacy and they have limited choices as well.
If individuals kind of don't have these choices, who is monitoring these companies? Is anyone looking at what operators are using this CenterPay scheme?
The short answer is yes, there is. The corporate regulator is looking at some of these companies, these rent-to-buy companies, and they've actually been quite active in terms of enforcement, so cracking down on companies that are doing the wrong thing. So ASIC says quite openly that the problem is that they keep sounding the alarm to Services Australia and saying, look, we've identified a whole range of companies, more than 100 companies that they are concerned about. And Services Australia is doing quite simply nothing in terms of reviewing those companies and taking them off the CenterPay register. So you have this quite incredible situation where the corporate regulator is saying, please, Services Australia, look at these companies. We are extremely concerned about them and what they're doing to vulnerable communities. And Services Australia is doing nothing to take them off the CenterPay register. So effectively, you've got, you know, more than 100 companies that are the subject of ASIC concern that Services Australia is continuing to allow to access people's welfare payments, which is quite extraordinary.
And we know that ASIC has taken action against at least four of these rent-to-buy companies. Some of those actions are still underway, so we can't really go into details. But they're doing their job in terms of, you know, monitoring these companies and investigating them. But of those four companies that ASIC currently has matters in court with, they're all still on the CenterPay register. And the other thing I want to mention is that these rent-to-buy schemes are often franchises. So people will tell you privately it's like playing whack-a-mole, that you might manage to monitor and have one of them taken off CenterPay, but then the model, the business model itself still remains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why you get some consumer advocates who say that the solution is this whole sector really shouldn't be accessing CenterPay because the sector is sort of almost built on this model of really charging quite high amounts for everyday goods, and that opens people who are vulnerable up to exploitation.
We've spoken a lot about these companies in the context of remote communities, but it's not only happening there, is it? I mean, Chris, you talked a lot in your joint investigation about a disgraced religious charity that was operating in Perth. Can you tell me about that and how they had allegedly used CenterPay basically as a form of financial control?
So the centre that we looked at was named Esther House. It's a rehabilitation service that was operating in Perth in Western Australia. The sorts of things that went on at Esther House have been very well publicised up to this point. So residents would go in there for drug and alcohol rehabilitation or for mental health treatment. It was a Christian-based rehabilitation service, but it was extreme in its practices. So it was allegedly subjecting people to exorcisms, to gay conversion therapy, forced baptisms, some really kind of quite severe forms of psychological stress. And there was an inquiry into it in 2022, into the practices that went on at Esther House that found that they were unacceptable and went undetected. So CenterPay fits into that model quite closely. And until now, until we looked at it, it hadn't really been publicly exposed just how central a role CenterPay was actually playing at Esther House. But what survivors were telling us, in we spoke to sort of four or five different survivors who went through this process, was that there was almost a form of coercion in terms of Esther House telling them, you must sign up to CenterPay. And that then gave Esther House early and guaranteed access to their welfare payments. And effectively what it did was it gave Esther House this sort of guaranteed income stream from the people that it was subjecting to some pretty horrific practices. So survivors say the effect on them of that was it left them feeling trapped there. They had lost control of their income, and that made it hard for them to leave. It made it hard for them to get out, and it just left them feeling like they were under a sort of form of financial control as well.
Was there any process in place at the time that should have or even could have prevented this from happening? You know, how did this go on without red flags getting raised somewhere along the system, I guess?
Yeah, so this was really a black hole, I guess, in terms of scrutiny. So with rent-to-buy companies, you have a regulator there that exists to look at them. In this case, with Esther House, there was no real regulation of this sector, this rehabilitation centre. And what that meant was really it was up to Services Australia to say, okay, well, who is this rehabilitation provider and what are they doing and what are the practices that are going on there and should they be approved to, you know, have early access to people's welfare payments? But that just simply didn't happen. There was no sort of scrutiny from Services Australia as to who this Esther House was and what they were doing. But we know it was being used en masse. So we know about 281 residents at Esther House were put onto CenterPay. We had spoken to one survivor who we've called Sarah, who said she was obliged to sign up because she'd seen other residents lose, you know, rights and privileges as a result of not signing up to CenterPay. So things like seeing their family, making phone calls or being able to leave the facility temporarily.
So what you find, Matilda, is that with the case of Esther House, the CenterPay problem that presents is that there was no means for Services Australia to determine whether the residents had voluntarily handed over their CenterPay entitlements to Esther House or were coerced into doing it. So they had no record of that. They couldn't tell. And it was only when Esther House collapsed and there was a big investigation into it in 2022 that some of these practices came to light. And so Services Australia were even forced to admit to the Senate late last year that it had no means of monitoring people's handing over their entitlements to a nominee. So that was a second big red flag for us, that wasn't just these rent-to-buy companies, but there were other institutions that were taking advantage of this flimsy system.
We'll be back after this.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
So, Chris, as we've been discussing this, we've been talking a lot about little companies. But when you and Lorena sort of started digging in, you found that this goes all the way up to the top as well, to like giants of the Australian economy. Currently, energy provider AGL is defending their use of CenterPay in court. What is it that they've been accused of doing?
Yeah, so the energy regulator, which has responsibility for regulating AGL, has lodged a case in the federal court, which basically accuses AGL of, in a nutshell, wrongly taking more than $700,000 using CenterPay from people who had ceased being customers. So what happened in the AGL case is that, you know, as we've discussed, CenterPay allows people to pay their electricity bills via that system. And so companies like AGL can come in, take take the money from a person's welfare payment before it gets to that welfare recipient's bank account and use it to cover their electricity bill. What is being alleged in the AGL case is that AGL was doing that and continued to do it for people who had left AGL, who were no longer AGL customers. And there was nothing to act as a red flag to alert AGL or Services Australia to the fact that actually we should stop taking people's money from CentrePay because they have ceased being customers. So this happened on quite a significant scale. So it was almost 600 customers. In many cases, the customers had ceased being with AGL years prior, and AGL just continued to take their welfare money using CentrePay.
What has AGL said so far in response to these claims?
So AGL is pretty clear that it doesn't have any control over CentrePay deductions itself. So it says that Services Australia is the body that is responsible for controlling a person's deductions. So that, you know, the responsibility, it is saying, effectively falls on the government and the customer to make sure that their deductions stop when they leave AGL. They also say that they didn't make any profit from any of this because that money all was just counted as credits on those individuals' accounts. They've also said that they've now refunded all of that money to the welfare recipients, and they reached out to the government pretty quickly to work it out. But I think that the crux of this is that there was just a giant system breakdown, and the harm of it was that it diverted $700,000 from the pockets of really vulnerable people and sent it wrongly to AGL. Whether or not AGL made profit off of it or not, that money was still taken away from people who really needed it to pay for everyday life.
So AGL saying that they don't have control over it, it's Services Australia's responsibility to cease these payments. What does Services Australia say?
Yes, well, herein lies the problem. Services Australia says, well, it is the responsibility of businesses to make sure that when a customer leaves, that there's something in place to ensure that their CentrePay deductions stop. So whether that's alerting the customer, telling them to stop the deductions, or having some sort of automated system to ensure that those deductions don't keep on being made. So you've got this situation really where Services Australia and AGL are both pointing at each other and laying the blame. And if you think of what that says for that industry as a whole, it's pretty worrying, because if nobody can quite work out whose responsibility it is, then it raises the very real prospect that this is happening elsewhere as well. In terms of what Services Australia have said directly, their spokesperson, Hank Yongen, has said that overpayments occurred usually when customers move house and did not, quote, actively manage their CentrePay deductions. And he said, quote, "We treat customer exploitation very seriously, and all instances of potential non-compliance are investigated. Potential non-compliance can be escalated to the agency directly through customer complaints or through escalation to the relevant regulatory bodies."
These are the same relevant regulatory bodies who are expressing frustration that when they advise Services Australia about businesses they have concerns about, that Services Australia aren't listening to them. And the other thing that Chris said that was really important there is that Services Australia is talking about customers not actively managing their CentrePay deductions. You look at who uses CentrePay, it's mostly people on disability support payments or Aboriginal people in remote communities. Neither one of those groups traditionally has good access to the internet to be able to access their, manage their things electronically. It's a lot of responsibility to place upon some very vulnerable people to be continually managing accounts that they, you know, may not always have access to online. And the other thing to point out is that of all of these businesses, the government has approved to use CentrePay. The assumption among welfare recipients is that they are therefore trustworthy. So there's an assumption that if the government says you're all right and I can deal with you, then I trust that you're going to not treat me badly.
Mm. Yeah, they have that tick of approval.
Yeah, that's right.
Which seems reasonable to believe would mean something.
Yes.
Who is responsible for fixing this at the end of the day? What needs to happen?
So Services Australia is telling us that they're in the middle of a review of the system, and they're conducting it quite urgently. One of the things they're looking at is stopping overpayments, as was made in the AGL case, and protecting vulnerable users of the system. There's a few issues with that. One is that there's already been a review that's been conducted about a decade ago. In 2013, it identified a lot of the issues that we're seeing again now, a decade on. So the same issues that were identified in this review in 2013 are still cropping up. We know that consumer advocates have been basically calling for a proper reform of this system for a decade, for a long, long time, and nothing has happened. And I think, you know, in those circumstances where we've already done a review, so identified these issues, nothing's happened to prevent them from happening, there is real concern about how effective this new review is going to be. The second problem with it, in my eyes, is that a lot of the issues that are cropping up lie in terms of responsibility with Services Australia. So if you have Services Australia reviewing a system in which it is partly to blame for the failings, you know, you're creating a very conflicted situation. And what is that review going to say about the fault of Services Australia? And what is it going to tell Services Australia about its own failings? I think we've all seen that the difficulties when bodies like the police decide to review themselves for misconduct and poor behaviour, it creates a conflict, and sometimes those conflicts can't be remedied. So it'll be interesting to see how that's dealt with.
What will it take to fix it? What needs to be done?
When you talk to the financial counsellors who work with these people, they've got a really strong opinion about this, and it seems to be fairly common among them that they think there's two ways to go, and either decision the government makes will require a huge review of the entire system. One argument is they should go back to basics. Centrepay used to be a system where people could pay for their rent and their power bills. So we'd just go back to that and take all of the other extraneous companies off the system. Or they have to take a greater role in monitoring and compliance and sort of attaching penalties to companies. So they have to be more judicious about who they let onto the register, and they need to be more careful and transparent about monitoring their compliance and working more closely with the industry regulators to make sure that they are behaving. So that those are the two choices.
It's just worth keeping in mind as well that, you know, though the government says that Centrepay is notionally a free and voluntary service for customers, there is a 99-cent fee that it imposes on the business for every transaction that's made. And last year alone, there were about 23.7 million transactions. So that's more than $20 million that's being returned to the government just by virtue of the use of this system alone. So it's worth just bearing in mind that limiting the use of this system will have a financial consequence for government.
I mean, going back to where this started and towards the start of your investigation, you talked about how there is this industry almost built up around Centrepay, especially in remote communities, but also that they are providing a service that no one else is. So if we do crack down, we do go back to basics, or we get rid of a lot of the more troubling companies, can vulnerable people live without it? Are we just going to leave this giant hole?
I think this is a really important issue because Centrepay in a way masks the bigger problem, which is the lack of goods and resources available to people in remote communities. So at the moment, Centrepay is a way that they can access things they cannot afford otherwise and are often very long way away. It costs money to travel. I mean, one example is a community in the Kimberley on the Gibb River Road. It's $800 worth of diesel to get to town to buy their supplies and come back again. So they have to, you know, chuck in money to pay for petrol to even get to town to do their shopping. So it's expensive for people to live remotely, and Centrepay makes it easier for them to manage their expenses. There's no two ways about it. I mean, financial counsellors have said to me, it's a good idea that's lost its way. So there is some benefits in the system, particularly for vulnerable people and Indigenous people in remote communities. If this system is not protecting the most vulnerable, then what's it going to do to fix that?
Thank you so, so much for joining me, Lorena and Chris. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Madeira.
No worries.
This episode was produced by Alison Chan and Miles Herbert. Sound design and mixing by Camilla Hannon. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.
how can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming-higher-education. This message was paid for by EY.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.